This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Adam Hochberg. For P.T. Duderman, joining the Navy in the early 1960s seemed like common sense. Somebody from his family had served in the military since the 1920s. P.T. rose in the ranks and eventually served as a Navy captain. Later, he took his skills to the Pentagon as an arms control specialist. But throughout his military career, P.T. was something else, a writer. When he left the service, he turned to fiction writing. For more than 20 years, he's written military novels. P.T. Duderman now lives in Rockingham County, north of the Triad, and his 19th novel is out today. It's called The Commodore. It tells the story of an unlikely naval hero during World War II. P.T. Duderman now joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the State of Things, P.T.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Give me an idea. How do you go from serving in the military to deciding you want to write about it? Were you out on your swift boat in Vietnam thinking, hey, great, this will make a wonderful story?
Not then, but I spent several tours in the Pentagon, and we wrote a lot of fiction in the Pentagon, so I was already capable of doing that. But when I retired, I told all my staff that I was going to go out and write novels for a living, and they said unanimously, "Oh, poor guy, you're going to starve." But I always have been a writer, high school, Naval Academy, in the Navy, and in the Pentagon, I was quite often asked to fix something someone else had written. And so I knew I could. What I didn't know was anything about the business.
Now, I've seen writing that's come out of the Pentagon. That is quite a job to rewrite Pentagon writing into something that a human being might
that
understand.
That a human can answer. And they told us when we had to write for the Chief of the Navy, Chief of Naval Operations, to go back to about the seventh grade, i.e. keep it very simple. John shot the cat. Subject, predicate, object. The reason for that was what he was reading, your magnum opus for the day, was one of about 3,000 pieces of paper he had to read, so you needed to keep it very simple and very clear.
Now, you've written several books about Vietnam, where you served. You've also written several about World War II, which was before your time. How's it different to write a historical novel rather than writing about a war that you yourself served in and saw with your own eyes?
My father was in World War II, and the books that I've done, Sentinels of Fire, The Commodore, Pacific Glory, he was in all of those battles. So I grew up with this. I grew up with him sitting around with his surviving classmates after dinner talking about, you remember this? Do you remember that guy? Remember that ship? Remember that fight? So it was kind of second nature to just go back to it, do my research to get it right, and then to unfocus it a little bit because I did not want to tread on the toes of actual ships and actual people who had suffered and died and been destroyed, sunk, or done very well.
Was it difficult to draw out your father? My dad was in World War II in the Army Air Corps, and he never really talked much about his service. The few stories I know were about when he could get a pass, get leave for a few days, and his hijinks exploring in China and elsewhere. Was your dad willing to talk about specifically what he did?
No.
Okay.
And none of them seemed to want to talk about that. They'd survived it. That's what they would say. That was rough. That was a bad one. And interestingly, as the books would come out, I would hear from the children of all the World War II vets who would never talk about it. And they would say, now I know why, and now I know what he did. I had no idea.
So your new book is The Commodore. It's about a World War II Navy man named Harmon Wolfe, or his friends call him Slough Wolfe. And he is, as you'd expect, the Commodore of an explorer squadron in the South Pacific. Tell us about Slough.
Well, he's an American Indian from the Iron Ore Range of up near Minnesota. He gets into the Naval Academy by a fluke, although he's quite bright mathematically. And he is not well accepted there because he's an American Indian. And in the Naval Academy of those days, in the 1930s, it was 100% middle class or upper class white men. So he's a bit of an oddity. But he becomes a football hero, and so they accept him for that. The same thing kind of happens in his career coming up to the point where the book begins. He is not one of us, and therefore he has to work a little harder. But But he does. He gets early command. He gets a destroyer and starts out his first assignment in the area around Guadalcanal by disobeying an admiral's orders, which makes him notorious. But he saves his ship, whereas all the other destroyers with him went down. And he ends up being the guy that goes and picks up their survivors. So he balances these acts of stepping out of line with a major success, either in sinking Jap ships or in rescuing people. He comes out smelling like a rose, and therefore the people that really don't like him very much can't touch him because Halsey likes him.
And Halsey is Admiral
right.
Bill Halsey, who is a real person who plays a prominent role in this fictional work.
Correct. And Halsey understands that the American way of war is pretty consistent. We begin getting our posteriori handed to us. We clear out the deadwood. We find the street fighters. We send them in, and we begin to win. And Halsey knows this, and he thinks that Harmon Wolfe is a street fighter. He's a brawler. He needs him. And so he rehabilitates him when he fails and sends him back in, and he succeeds.
You have a passage that you've picked out to read for us. Can you first set up, tell us what we need to know about what's happening in this scene?
Well, what's happened is, this is about a third of the way into the book, and Harmon Wolfe, as a skipper of a ship, has gotten a new commodore. His boss is called the commodore. And in Navy parlance, commodore means an officer in command of many ships. Not an admiral, but a four-stripe captain, typically, who has five, six ships under his command. And the new commodore comes up to his cabin and wants to, as we used to say when I was a commodore, share his thinking with Harmon Wolfe.
Okay, here's writer P.T. Duderman reading from his new novel, The Commodore.
"Tell me about the battleship fight," the commodore said, "and why did USS King leave the formation?" "Whoops," Slough thought. "Word does get around." He nodded and related what he told Halsey, and when he was finished, the commodore sat there without saying anything. Then he got up, began to pace around the cabin. "That will not happen under my command, Captain. I want to make sure you understand that." "Yes, sir," says Slough. "Unfortunately, we didn't have a unit commander for the destroyers, and Admiral Lee..." The commodore turned and shook his finger sideways. "Admirals do not normally communicate with individual ship captains. But when they do, it is incumbent on you to follow the last order given and not to take independent action. Our last order from Admiral Lee was to open fire when the battleships did." "Not talking about that," the commodore said. "Talking about your last stationing order. The last order to you was to take station in the van. Absent any other orders, that's where you were supposed to stay and be torn up by the long lance torpedoes that I knew were coming." "You could not know that," the commodore pointed out. "You might suppose that, but you could not know that. And yet we're here now, and the rest of the van destroyers are on the bottom of Iron Button Sound." The commodore stared at him, and then he asked the executive officer who was in the room to give us a minute, please. The exec got up and left the cabin. When the door closed, the commodore sat back down and said, "You're new to this, Wolf. Your ship is new, your crew is new, you are new. That's the only reason I'm not going to relieve you of command right here and now. Here's a secret you apparently don't know. When a senior officer gives an order, it just might be that he knows a lot more than you do about the tactical situation. He may or he may not have time to bring you into the picture. He may only have time to give you that order. And when the senior officer does that, and if the junior officer does something else, it can screw everything up. In your case, it didn't. But you make a habit of obeying some orders and not others, inevitably it will. I have to know, right now, that if I give you tactical orders, you will obey them to the letter, and you will not improvise according to your instincts, hunches, or superstitions." "Yes, sir," Slough said.
Writer P.T. Duderman reading from his new novel, The Commodore. So Slough is the hero of your book, but he's not necessarily the prototypical military hero. He makes mistakes. He suffers some devastating defeats. Without giving away too much of the book, he suffers some terrible injuries. Why did you put him through those kinds of trials?
Because actually, real military heroes do, in fact, suffer injuries and make mistakes and do the wrong thing. Happens all the time.
The other thing you mentioned earlier, he's Native American.
Yes.
I would imagine there were not many Native American people in World War II in real life who reached that level of leadership in the armed forces. But perhaps I'm wrong about that.
There was one, and this was the skipper of the destroyer at the Battle of Leyte Gulf that decided when all was lost, four Japanese battleships were bearing down on the amphibious force off of Leyte. He turned around and took his destroyer and went after the first battleship in the column. Now, he tore up the top hampers of that ship so badly with his 5-inch guns that the admiral, Kurita, decided he was facing a heavy cruiser, and there were more coming. They were actually all destroyers, destroyer escorts. It was an astonishing thing. The admiral, the Japanese admiral, turned the formation around and left because he figured if this is just the cruisers, the battleships can't be far behind. Now, there was no way this destroyer could hurt a battleship. But if he put enough 5-inch rounds up into the bridge area where the admiral and the captain and the staff officers all were, and they found themselves lying on the deck bleeding with all the windows shot out and all the noise blowing out their ears, it hadn't hurt the battleship. It scared the living hell out of the admiral, and he left. He had the preponderance of force. He had everything going for him. He had victory in his grasp, and he left because of this one destroyer skipper. His name was Evans, and I think he was a full-blooded Cherokee.
So is the character of Wolf based on that real person?
No.
Just a coincidence.
Right. It is a coincidence, but it's not fair to say there weren't any, because there were.
So why did you decide to make Harmon Wolf a Native American?
I needed him to be different, not just another white guy, if you will, making his way up the ranks of the academy class of, I forget which one in his case. But he's already starting with a strike against him. He's not one of us. He's not one of us. He's an upstart. Well, so was Halsey, in a fashion, particularly when Halsey was facing Guadalcanal.
So when you served in Vietnam, race relations had advanced somewhat from the mid-1940s, maybe not enough as they should have. Did you see those kinds of tensions, those kinds of pressure on minority sailors that you served with?
I got to tell you, we didn't have any minority sailors in my swift boat squadron. We didn't. And I did go through the period in about 1968 when the Navy finally came to grips and said, all right, enough is enough. I made the example, if you saw five sailors back on the fantail of a ship having a cigarette after dinner, they were having a cigarette after dinner. But the mindset was such in those days, if you saw five black sailors having a cigarette on the fantail, they were plotting a race riot. And it was
that was the perception.
That was the perception. Yeah. And so finally we had to address that and simply sit down with people and ask them, why do you think that? They went to boot camp just like you did. They do the same jobs just like you do. Why would you think that? And the answer inevitably was, And then, God bless them, because the Navy is filled with really good people, they came around. We got it out in the open. We had some problems. We had some problems on ships. But in the Navy, if you have a problem, you bring it out on the table. You face it. Find out what's behind it. You fix it and you move on. That's our ethic. And it worked. And it took a chief of naval operations to set that in motion. And I think end once and for all the problem of you know, race relations in the Navy, it's gone away.
Well, I was going to ask you that. You've been out of the military service now for a couple of decades, but I was going to ask if you think that those tensions still exist.
I don't. You get the odd racist on both sides of the fence, but no, I don't. It is, unremarkable. On one of my ships, we had one black officer in the sea. He was a supply officer, very good supply officer. But he's black, you know. People would say things like that. Now it is unremarkable. You don't notice. I mean, that's not an issue, and I don't think it'll ever will be again.
Do you have the opportunity now to talk with current sailors or current service members from any of the branches about writing, about your experiences?
Yep. I have people come in on my website and ask questions like that. And I get some letters once in a while saying, how did you manage this? How did you do it? How did you get started? And I'll tell them.
What do you tell young people now who may want to make the same transition you did from service member to author?
I tell them one fact of life. You can either do this or you can't. It's kind of like playing the piano. If you can split your brain, drive your left hand in your right hand, you can play the piano. If you can't do that, you can't do that. So first, try it and see if you can do that. If it's comfortable and it comes to you and it's smooth and you enjoy it, do that. But don't butt your head for years and years trying to get that first novel done, because it might be that you just can't do that.
Okay, so for the ones who can do that, what's the pathway to do it?
Write the book. Really and truly, you can talk about the book, your great plans for the book, a concept, an outline, but what an agent wants to see is da book. They want to see it. And they have the same question that I just talked about. Can you do it? Well, you've answered that question. I done it. There's the book. Secondly, get an agent. The publishing industry will not talk to authors anymore. The over-the-transom business is all gone. They'll only talk to agents. If you can convince an agent that it's a good book, that it's a sellable book, it'll get published. But that's your first commercial filter. That's the first time that you meet the market, the agent. So getting a good and productive agent is almost more important than getting a publisher.
Do you have particular influences who helped you either in your early days or still are people who that you influence you now? You wrote in the acknowledgments of this book, Neptune's Inferno, which is not a novel. It's a narrative history by James Hornfisher, and you acknowledge that as being an inspiration.
Very much so.
For this book. Are there others?
Funny enough, once you get to writing for a living, you don't get to read anymore. And the reason for that is time. And secondly, you don't want to unconsciously lift material from other writers. You read a great book, you see a colorful phrase or a story, and then it appears in maybe not your next book, but the one after that. And now you're in trouble. So I don't actually get to read anywhere near as much as I want to.
Do you ever worry about being overly influenced by yourself? I mean, you've written 19 books now. Do you ever get concerned that what I'm writing in book number 19 is too similar to what I wrote in book number 4?
Always a possibility, I suppose. And my copy editor, who is wonderful, catches me in every book where I do something like repetition of a particular word or a sentence structure, beginning everything with a passive clause. And she will come back and she said, you've done it again. I caught you at this 2 books ago. Stop doing that. Then I have to rewrite it. But that of course you do.
Writer P.T. Duderman, his new military novel is called The Commodore, and it's out today. Thanks for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Just ahead, we'll preview a live performance inspired by the work of North Carolina photographer David Speer.